There always has to be something to keep it interesting and see who's paying attention. And if you were paying attention, you heard in the first reading Moses at the ripe old age of 120 giving his parting thoughts to the children of Israel that he'd been leading for 40 years because they were about to part ways. Those 600,000 Hebrews were going to cross the Jordan on dry ground to enter the promised land, finalizing their journey. But Moses' journey was to end sooner than that. He was going to die. He was going to be buried within distance of the promised land. He could see it, but he was not allowed to enter into it. Why? Because in Numbers chapter 20, when Israel was complaining about how thirsty they were in the desert, they said, "Give us something to drink." God told Moses, "Take your staff, strike the rock, and water will burst forth from it." Well, Moses struck the rock, and there was water, but there was just one problem. God told Moses, "Strike the rock once." Moses did it twice, as if somehow once wouldn't be sufficient. Well, we're in your neighborhood of God. Once is more than enough. Seems like a minor infraction to us, but as a penalty for that, God said, "Moses, you'll continue to lead my people, but where they're going, you cannot come." And that's why he is about to die, and he's giving them some reflections before he does, to learn from his own experience. When given the choice, trust in God, heed his commands, and good things will happen to you. He didn't want them to suffer the same fate that was his, to be able to see his dream, to be able to smell its air, but not be able to walk on its soil. And so he tells them, God's law, it is not far from you. You don't have to send someone to heaven to bring it back to you or across the sea to go reach out for it. It's already on your lips and in your hearts. All you have to do is carry it out. Both before and after this passage that conclude Deuteronomy and Moses' life and Israel's journey, Moses said again and again, choose God, observe his commands, keep his statutes, and you will have long life in the land you're about to enter. He said these words about 1,100 years before the birth of Jesus, and perhaps it explains why the Old Testament is so long, because the people that entered the promised land had trouble having long life in the land because they had trouble keeping God's commandments, heeding his statutes. They were always taken in with the worship of false and empty gods. They feared the God that does exist. They liked to offer incense and sacrifice to false gods who couldn't answer their prayers because at least they also couldn't destroy them. And thus it was that time and again, the children of God in Israel were kicked out of their land because they did not obey God's commands. That explains why they ended up as slaves in Assyria to the north, Babylon to the east, Persia from the south. Then there would be the Macedonians, the Greeks, and the Romans in succession, all in the space of 1,000 years. Why? Because they did not keep that law of the Lord on their lips and in their heart. They acted like it was far from them. All you have to do is observe those commands, Moses said. It would have been so different for him and for them if they had. But what's interesting to note is that no matter how unfaithful Israel was to God, God was not unfaithful to Israel. His law were his marriage vows, how he would honor them, how they should honor him, and how they both would be blessed because of it. And no matter how sinful or idolatrous Israel became, God never said, Israel, I divorce you. I'm going to choose the Macedonians or the Persians or the Assyrians. He always continued to prepare them for himself and for the coming of his son. And he always forgave them for their faults and failings. He just said, return to me with your whole heart, as Moses encourages them and us to do today. Jesus also speaks about the law in the gospel. He and the scholar are debating, what are the greatest commandments? We've heard this before. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Who is my neighbor? That's a good question. And so Jesus uses the story of the Good Samaritan to drive home this point. We've heard this story so often, it seems to me like something that many people think is a true story. In fact, when I was in the Holy Land 20 years ago, our guide took us to a spot in the desert and said, this is where the Good Samaritan happened. I think he wanted a tip. So it's not a true story, but it tells truths about the human condition that we'd rather not get our hands dirty. We'd rather not have to waste our time getting involved in someone else's problems. And so when Jesus tells the story about this innocent man who's just minding his own business, and all of a sudden he's attacked, he's robbed, he's mugged, left for dead, who are the people that should have been the first and most willing to help him? The priest and the Levite. After all, they parade around to the temple in fine robes and give everybody the impression that they're very holy and helpful. And yet, not only do they not help him, whoosh, they have to get as far from him as possible. Let's go the other way. Why this? Perhaps it's because they're already in their temple robes and they don't want to risk getting some blood and dirt on them. Maybe they just looked at the time on the sundial and realized we'll be late for temple if we stop and mess with this man's problems. But more likely than not, it's simply because too many people, the Pharisees, the priests of that time included, believed if someone was suffering, it was a punishment from God. God sent somebody to mug that man and beat him half to death. So we don't want to mess with him, or else his Jewish karma is going to become our own. And whatever his plight is will soon be ours. And that's why they had to stay away. Of course, as so often the case when Jesus is telling a story, the least likely candidate becomes the hero of the story. And that is the Samaritan. Samaritans were to be avoided at all costs. They were discriminated against in every possible way. The Jewish law and the Talmud said you could not breathe the same air as them, touch them, talk with them, do business with them, or go into their towns. And yet the Samaritan, who knows clearly that these Jewish people find him unlovable, untouchable, and unclean, he's the only one willing not just to stop, but to truly help. Nurse the man's wounds, getting himself dirty in the process, put him on his own beast of burden, take him to an inn and pay for his room, and promise to come back and pay for more if he should require further care. What a great man. What a great Samaritan. But for the people who are listening to Jesus telling this story, including the scholar of the law, to put great and Samaritan in the same sentence, that would have been a foreign concept. The people of Judah, the true Jewish people, looked down their noses at the Samaritans because they thought they had watered down pure Jewish blood and pure Jewish faith. And it all stemmed from an invasion that happened to Israel. Why? Because they did not keep God's commands. And so they weren't fighting for God. God wasn't fighting for them. And it was the Assyrian Empire that invaded from its capital, Nineveh, to the north of Israel in 787 BC. And they conquered Samaria, which was the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel. And from the moment of that invasion, 8 centuries before the coming of the Christ, all the men of Samaria were taken back to Assyria to be slaves. And the Assyrian men moved into their homes and took the Jewish men's wives as their own and brought their pagan gods and pagan customs along with them. And from that moment on, people in the southern kingdom of Judah, where Jesus was, where Jerusalem is, where the temple is, they would have nothing more to do with those Samaritans who they looked as half-breeds and sellouts. Jesus, as you recall, often went into Samaritan towns, touched Samaritan people, and did some of his greatest miracles for their benefit, and they were some of the quickest to believe. But in the story of the Good Samaritan, we find that it is the one man who is hated by most, unloved by all, who is the one willing to show the greater love. Because Jesus tells us time and again, he came not for the healthy, but for the sick, not for the righteous, but for the sinful. And so he could have cared less about the worldly, the wealthy, and the wise. He was looking for the last, the lowest, the least, the leper, and the lame. And the Good Samaritan knew it. The Good Samaritan was willing to see that in someone else, and he was willing to get his hands dirty to help that man. Jesus gave a great command at the end of the story, 4 words, go and do likewise. Telling the scholar of the law and all who hear the story, we're called to make time and to get into that grime. When we see suffering, we should do something to try to stop it. Because if the shoe is on the other foot, we hope some stranger would do the same for us. That's how we love our neighbor as ourself. But go and do likewise. There's one other time that Jesus said that exact same seemingly insignificant phrase, and it was the last night of his life. In the Last Supper in the upper room on Mount Zion, he began that meal, the preparation of the Passover, by washing the feet of his apostles. He who Colossians describes today as being the one through whom all things come to exist, this King of Kings and Prince of Peace, who's all grandeur and majesty and glory, humbled himself by washing the stinky, smelly feet of those men who wandered the desert with him. But when he was finished doing that, he said, "This I have done for you as an example. Now go and do likewise." Same exact thing. Jesus came not only to give his life for us, but to show us how to be life and love and mercy for each other.